You're listening to the Darebin Fuse Festival. This five-part podcast series is a collaboration with the First Time Podcast and is part of Darebin's Spring Festival program. Conversations were recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and we'd like to acknowledge them as the traditional owners and custodians of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future. Episodes in this Fuse series will be released fortnightly and feature local creatives Kate McLennan, Leanne Hall, Eve Reese, Clementine Ford, and McKinley Valentine. Happy listening. Dr. Eve Reese is an award-winning writer, historian, and podcaster. At present, Eve is a lecturer in history at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. They are the recipient of the 2020 Calibre Essay Prize, awarded for their essay, Reading the Mess Backwards. Eve is the co-host with Claire Wright of the podcast Archive Fever, and they are a regular contributor to ABC Radio. Their writing has featured in Guardian Australia, Overland, Inside Story, ABC Online, Archer, The Conversation, and the Australian Book Review. I am very, very keen to talk about the Calibre Prize, but Eve Reese, before we do, can we go back a little and start at the very start? Did you always want to write?
I did. I was kind of the classic bookish child and young adult. I grew up kind of essentially as an only child because I have a half-brother, but he grew up in Melbourne and I grew up in Newcastle. So I, you know, had the kind of childhood of a lot of time spent alone with my head in books. And books and reading were very much my first love. I loved storytelling. So, yeah, being a writer had always been my my kind of fantasy dream career. I remember when I was a young teenager, I started writing you know, a kind of young adult story to amuse myself. And I was about, I don't know, 12 or 13 at the time, and confidently thinking, oh, I'll definitely publish my first book by the time I'm 16. That's so many years away. Like, you know, be easily done. You know, and here I am, more than double that age later. Not actually having had published a book yet. But certainly, yeah, I've always found writing frightening and hard, but I've always, you know, it's one of the things that's always made me feel most alive, and and reading has always been one of my greatest pleasures. So I think I went into my kind of my main career today, which is being an academic historian, in part because I sort of realised it was one of the kind of few careers that would pay you a kind of regular salary to essentially be a writer.
It's hard to get the regular salary, isn't it? Remember the first thing you got published? Was it an academic piece of work or was it something else?
I think it probably was an academic piece of work. I was a bit of a kind of precocious student who, you know, put all my energies into my studies. So I got my honours thesis published as an article shortly.
It's a big win. I remember doing honours, and that was something that was sort of on the table, but you had to be fairly exceptional to get it to happen. What was your honours thesis
about? Yeah. It was about, so I've kind of always been fascinated by the lives of, I suppose, kind of unconventional women, like women who push the boundaries of what was, you know, a standard women's life at their time, which, you know, in retrospect seems a lot about my own efforts to understand gender. But so my honours thesis was about one of these kind of women. It was a really fascinating artist and art educator who was from Melbourne, born in the 1890s, but then in the 1920s, when she was a young adult, she moved to New York and had this really kind of extraordinary life as a single woman and an artist kind of living in bohemian art circles in New York for the rest of her life. But she came back to Australia many times. Her name was Mary Cecil Allen, and her family were quite a kind of establishment Melbourne family. So she was sort of got a lot of attention when she came back to Melbourne, and played a really important role in kind of bringing new ideas about modernism and modernity from New York to Melbourne. So I kind of, my research on her focused on her sort of role as a conduit of kind of new ideas between New York and Australia.
Oh, fascinating. And so when you're writing for a more academic audience, what does your writing process look like?
I suppose it, like, I'd like it to be able to say it's a more kind of, you know, organised, structured process than it actually is in reality. But I suppose I think I'm a fairly intuitive writer, whether I'm doing kind of, you know, academic scholarly writing or more kind of conventional creative pieces. So, I mean, obviously, you know, one of the distinguishing features of academic writing is that it's based on research. You know, often like months or years of research going into archives, finding new material, and also reading, you know, all the kind of existing books and articles that have kind of been written around this topic. And, you know, I hear on the grapevine that some academic writers, you know, then approach, like, they've done all this research and they approach the writing stage very methodically. You know, they write wonderful summaries of everything they've read and have really great plans what they're going to write. But I don't really like that at all, I have to say. I kind of have a moment where it all kind of gels in my head and I feel like I, you know, I have my argument, I have the thing I want to say, and I'm very, like, I get very obsessed with titles and openings. So I spend a lot of time kind of meditating on, you know, what is the title of this piece? And once I kind of have the title, I really know what it's about. Wow. And then I obsess. Yeah. I know a lot of people say they don't, like, come up with titles until the end. And I find that just incoherent. Like, I just cannot understand that. I need a title to know what I'm writing.
Is a title for an academic, like a journal article, is it more revealing of what the entire piece is about? Is that one typical
or not? Yes and no. I mean, they can conventionally be very descriptive and a bit kind of bland, and, you know, will often signal a bit of, like, you know, the subject matter of the piece, but also its kind of argument, like, the, you know, the point it's trying to make. But I often, you know, I do try to kind of make them a bit playful and creative as well. So once I kind of see working at the title as an opportunity to come up with the argument, the contribution, but also the kind of creative flavour of what I'm going to write.
Interesting.
And then I get very obsessed with how I'm going to open it, because academics love a good anecdote as an opening scene to draw people in. So I probably spend a bit too much time obsessing over how I'm going to do that. But that, I think, for me kind of really sets it up in my head. Once I've kind of got the title and the opening down, then it just kind of flows from there, I suppose.
And will it change much beyond that? Or once you have it, it really is pretty set?
I think I'm a kind of writer who writes fairly slowly but edits a lot as I go. So I don't do the kind of big, messy, like vomiting on the page first draft where I just kind of write stream of consciousness and don't, you know, self-censor much and then come back to it. So you know, I might only write like a couple of paragraphs a day, but, you know, I spend a lot of time as I'm doing that obsessing over like each word and each sentence. So once I'm kind of got those initial paragraphs down, I won't, and then have a kind of full first draft. I tend not to go back to, you know, then like pick apart the whole piece very much. And that's just the kind of style that I've worked at fits best for me over time. That's just kind of the way my brain works when I'm writing.
And so what does publication look like? How do you get published?
So academia is a very weird world in terms of publication. Well,
that's why I ask. I feel like it must be so different to writing fiction.
Yeah. Well, you know, I suppose for me, like, academic publishing is still what I'm most familiar with. So for me, like, the kind of, you know, the world of fiction and creative nonfiction is the kind of strange new world I'm discovering at the moment. But academic writing, there's two main forms people write. There's books, or what are sometimes called monographs, particularly in my discipline, history, which is, you know, the kind of the grand history of whatever you're writing about. Then there's journal articles. And more and more people are prioritising publishing in journals because, well, there's a few reasons for that. Like, one of them is the whole model of academia is getting pushed more and more to kind of follow the model of the hard sciences, and they've always privileged publishing in journals rather than books. So humanities subjects like history are kind of getting pushed in that direction. Also, you know, journal articles are kind of quicker than books, so there's been more and more emphasis to kind of get publications out more quickly in a kind of publish or perish mindset. So journal articles have become increasingly popular, but they're just a kind of whole weird world. So it's a very slow process. Journals are ranked, kind of there's a very clear hierarchy of what are the most prestigious journals. In Australia, international journals tend to be more prestigious because, you know, we have a notorious cultural cringe. And the thing you want to get published goes through what's called a peer review process, which is the kind of main gatekeeping system in academia to make sure research is kind of credible and, you know, to ensure, you know, standards are maintained. And
like the Goodreads?
Yeah.
Are people horrible, or are they sort of...
Horrible. Like, it's a great idea in principle, but in practice... You know, often you don't get very useful feedback from the readers. Often, like, they just kind of miss the point because they might be busy or overworked themselves. And there is a kind of notorious culture of, like, quite nasty criticism that people get. And it's just an incredibly slow process because, you know, you have to submit the article to the journal editors. They need to kind of give it an initial once-over to see if they're going to send it out for peer review. Then the peer reviewers can often take months and months and months to get back to you because they're so busy and they're trying to fit it in their workload. And no one gets paid for any of this, I should say. It's all voluntary labour that's sort of seen as just part of our vocation as being an academic. And then when you get the reviews back off, like, it almost never that they say, this is great, just publish it is. You know, even if it's a good piece of work, there'll always be some revision, often quite significant revision. Then that could take, you know, another 6 months. Often it might have to go out to peer review a second time to kind of get the okay from the initial reviewers that it's okay to publish. You might have to do a second round of revisions.
So that's the peer review process is about... acceptance. Everyone has to agree to accept.
Yeah, it's a gatekeeper.
Yeah, it's different in that respect, isn't it?
And so what it does is it lends itself to a kind of conservatism, I suppose, that because you are being constantly judged and evaluated by peers, which are more senior than you, it lends itself to reproducing the status quo. Like, the things that peer reviewers tend to like are things that have already been out there and are accepted as scholarly ideas or writing, you know, or theoretical approaches that are new and provocative and challenge the kind of quite, in many ways, quite rigid norms of academic writing. I mean, that's not to say they'll never get through, but they have a harder time getting accepted. And, I mean, it's a balancing act because, you know, you can say it is important that this is scholarship, it's not, you know, just art or, you know, creativity. It's important that there are certain standards to be upheld. But it does certainly create a kind of a bit of a herd mentality and a bit of a conservatism, which I think many people working in academia find quite challenging at times. And then you go through this whole process, which takes years. And then if your piece finally gets published, you'll get published in an academic journal, which is behind a paywall. So members of the public won't be able to access it. Only people affiliated with the university be able to access it. And even fewer people will want to read it. So you've gone through this potentially 2, 3, 4 year process, and then you might get, you know, 10 or 20 people who read it at the end of the day.
Well, I guess the reading market must be different in the sense that I guess when a book comes out, generally the most sales or the most readers might be in that first initial 3, 4, 5, 6 months, unless the book does extremely well. But I guess journal articles are designed to exist for a much longer period of time, aren't they?
They are. And I mean, in a weird way, journal articles are not about getting readers. They're about that they exist as forms of displaying your status, like they're markers of excellence. It's a way of saying my research is so good that it got into this particular journal, which is known to be very hard to get into, and I'm now in conversation with the elite level of people who are living in this journal. So actually the number of readers in the strange world of academia is kind of irrelevant. It's about journal you get into, and then it's about how often you get cited by other subsequent academic publications who are referencing your work and therefore kind of creating this vision of it as a particularly significant or important piece of work. To put it crudely, it's about quality, not quantity. I mean, of course, having, spent hundreds of hours of one's time, one would often like more readers, but in terms of, in the academic universe, in terms of the success of a piece of writing, the number of readers is not the most important thing by any means.
One of the things we talk about on this podcast a lot is sort of the emotional experience of publication, and this feeling that a bit of yourself is in the world. Does that sense of attachment exist for your more academic work?
Certainly it does. I think for me, particularly because I, even with academic writing, I'm just quite obsessive about the craft of writing. Mm. So I suppose I see what I put out there is not only a kind of reflection of my research and my ideas, but it's, it's meant to be hopefully a somewhat beautiful, elegant piece of writing. So I definitely see whatever I put out in the world as a part of me, which has interestingly got quite complicated recently in the last few years as I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment, I've come out as trans, which has involved changing my name. So I have almost 10 years worth of academic publications under the name I was assigned at birth, which is not the name I use now, Eve, which is my chosen name. So I have these kind of like little artifacts of my former self floating around under this old name. And that feels really complicated, I suppose, because for a lot of those pieces of work, I'm still proud of them. I'm glad they exist. I want people to read them and engage with those ideas. But, I'm not that person anymore. And for some trans people, it causes a huge amount of pain and distress to be confronted with their birth name or their dead name, as it's often called. I don't have that extreme level of distress around that name. But it's not my name. And it feels... I've had some interesting, complex conversations and thought processes about, how should those pieces be cited if someone is, referencing an article I wrote 6 years ago under my birth name, but they want to engage with that work, but they want to be respectful to the person I am now. So it
feels kind of very complex.
having these little sort of seeds of my past life floating around in the world.
Which is probably a good segue. Let's talk about the Caliber Prize, which your essay, Reading the Mess Backwards, won. For listeners that haven't heard of the Caliber Prize, it's an incredibly prestigious prize for an original nonfiction essay. Firstly, Eve, congratulations. It's such a phenomenal essay. I had the pleasure of actually listening to you read it. They did a podcast version.
They did, yes.
Great.
Which was very funny to record from at home during lockdown. I kind of created an improvised recording studio under a doona to try
block out excessive noise. It totally worked. The way you describe the essay is that it is a story of trans becoming that digs into the messiness of bodies, gender and identity. Let's start again with the writing process. What did it look like for this? Was it different?
It was obviously different in that it wasn't a research-based piece. You know, it's a personal essay, it's a piece of memoir. But it was, in a way, weirdly similar in that it was like a kind of very intuitive thing to write. You know, I had, again, the title and the opening sequence in my mind, then it just kind of flowed out of me, and I wrote the first draft at least fairly quickly, and it wasn't something I kind of planned. It just sort of, I'd write one section and the next would just kind of materialise in my mind. When I think about my writing, I suppose I think a lot about kind of the rhythm and the musicality of what I'm writing, my sentences, which is kind of odd because I'm actually not at all a musical person in any other way. I don't play an instrument. I don't even listen to music a whole lot. But I just kind of really get into a kind of, I suppose, flow state where I really sit with the kind of the rhythm and the sound of sentences and paragraphs. And that kind of gives me an intuitive sense of where I want to go next. And in many ways, that process has been the same across my kind of personal essays and my more academic writing.
We talk to a lot of writers that also work as editors about how being an editor influences writing and how being a writer influences editing. I'm interested in what that is like as an academic historian writing memoir. Does it make it easier or does it make it more difficult?
I mean, it was interesting because in a sense, you know, I've spent years writing histories and this was me writing my own personal history. And, you know, it's a true history and that it's true of my emotional experience of it. But I suppose I also am very aware of how singular that story is, I suppose, that, you know, it's one telling of my journey through life and particular events in my life, one history that could be told, but there are many other histories that could be told. So I suppose there was a kind of interesting interrelationship between my kind of my memoir writing self and my historian brain. The historian brain kind of gave me a bit of a kind of conceptual framework to be comfortable with the constructedness of my own history, to realise that, you know, it's okay if it wasn't the authoritative, perfect, conclusive history of what this period of my life was like, because that would never be possible. But then my memoir self, just seeing how created this history is, I suppose, how much of a piece of created art this was rather than just like a true document, made me realise more than ever as a historian how I suppose history is an art form. History is never the kind of social science, the objective scholarly pursuit that we often like to pretend it is. I mean, it's can be grounded in facts, but it's ultimately a form of narrativizing the past. It's a storytelling art. And, you know, stories are created by humans and they could always be created differently. You can always tell, you know, an infinite number of stories about the same sequence of, you know, events.
So the language around gender and gender diversity has really evolved over the past few years. And in your essay, you talk about the absence of language to understand your experiences. How has the evolution of language helped?
It's been absolutely crucial. You know, as I talk about in the essay, when I was growing up in the 1990s and the early 2000s, there was no language circulating, certainly not in my kind of universe, around gender diversity or even really queerness. And that just left me with a really just kind of inchoate sense of wrongness, of not fitting in my body and my life. And that just, you know, sense of wrongness that I or no one else was able to articulate was actually incredibly traumatic. It's been, you know, the kind of proliferation of language around gender diversity in the last kind of 5 to 10 years has been so crucial in kind of giving a language to articulate my own experience and to make sense of my experience. And most fundamentally, to make me feel like I'm not alone in my experience, that it's real, that other people have had similar experiences and that it's, you know, legitimate. So, you know, while I'm kind of in a sense wary of using language to kind of trying to pin down, you know, our subjective worlds or our gender identities, you know, we're always so much more than language. Language is always imperfect in that way. I am such a huge believer in the importance of language and then, you know, in cultural representation to help make meaning to our kind of messy, emotional, raw sense of the world. And from that meaning, just have a sense of community and belonging, to feel like there are people other than us having this kind of experience, which is so incredibly important, I think, when you're part of any marginalised identity. I mean, not just trans people, but also for, you know, for people of colour, for migrants, for disabled people, any kind of, you know, category of people who aren't often represented in culture and art. When we don't have a kind of a language given to us through culture and art to make sense of our experiences, we can often just, I think, feel like we're the only person in the world and that we're going insane. And, you know, I mean, obviously art alone is not going to solve the world's inequities and structural kind of oppressions, but I really believe that art and representation is a huge starting point in making people feel seen and feel real and feel part of communities. Because language is power. Like, language enables us to articulate what we're experiencing, and it gives us a framework to challenge the status quo. Without language, we're just kind of locked in this like messy, inchoate sense of wrongness, which I was locked in for many, many years, and I do not recommend.
I think it also builds empathy too, to help people understand that experience.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what I've, you know, been talking about, I suppose, is the power of language and representation for, you know, individuals from that identity. But for other people, I think it's crucial in forging a sense of empathy and understanding. And I mean, in a way, that's kind of, you know, my ideal audience is to bridge those two groups. I want to speak to other trans and gender diverse people and kind of create some of the art that I wish I had experienced growing up, but also just give a kind of a little glimmer into what it's like to be inside the head of someone who is not cisgender. And then in doing so, to kind of, you know, through that language, prompt people to question gender, you know, more broadly, and I suppose reflect on how arbitrary it is, and how so much about gender, as with all kind of systems of, you know, organizing the world into kind of groups of people, how incredibly violent they tend to be. I mean, even for the people who fit inside these systems, they still are restrictive. They still limit what we can see and what we can be and who we see as like us or not like us. So I suppose, you know, I mean, this is quite ambitious, but my ultimate goal in this kind of writing is to kind of destabilize all these kind of categories of, you know, man, woman, you know, white, person of colour, like all these kind of, you know, able, disabled, all these kind of categories of self and other that we take for granted.
Well, it's fascinating in the essay you mention fashion, I think, and also change rooms. I mean, change rooms is something people always bring up, but fashion was probably one I hadn't thought about quite so much. That observation of the small everyday experiences is really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think being an outsider in any context kind of makes you an expert on that context, because you see, you experience at an embodied level the way the rules of that context work. And that's certainly my experience of gender. You know, I had 30 years of my life thinking I was cisgender, though, you know, never quite fitting for me, and then coming out as trans. And not only as a trans person, but a non-binary person, so a person who doesn't fit into boxes. And, you know, what that does, I mean, it's, you know, it's challenging in many ways, but it really makes you an expert on the gender binary, because you see this binary play out in all sorts of really mundane, but very, you know, again, quite violent ways in everyday life, you know. And one context that often gets discussed in the context of trans people is, you know, public toilets, public bathrooms, how they're kind of rigidly policed into male and female toilets and how kind of absurd that is. But also for me, one of the, you know, most kind of tricky spaces to navigate, as I write about in the essay, is fashion and change rooms. And my kind of, you know, really just sort of stumbling path to trying to think about, well, if I am not a woman, if I am a non-binary but transmasculine person, you know, kind of closer towards the male or female end of the spectrum, what does that look like in terms of the clothes I wear? And where do I buy those clothes? And, you know, how do I even, you know, find clothes that fit me? Because, you know, like in Australia particularly, I think there's a very, very kind of rigid idea of what a man's body looks like. And that's a kind of big, hulking, broad-shouldered man. So, you know, as I write about it, it's just almost impossible to even find clothes that, you know, were small enough that would fit me. And, you know, just even really subtle things about the tailoring of blazers. You know, I had an interesting discussion with a friend recently who, a cis female friend, who sent me a photo of a black blazer that she thought was my style and I might want to buy. And I said, look, this is a great, lovely blazer, but it's a woman's blazer and I don't wear women's clothes anymore. And she was kind of a bit thrown by that, saying, but like, for me, it just looks like an androgynous blazer. Like, it's, you know, yes, I see it's being marketed as a women's blazer, but I think it could be worn by anyone. But, you know, my response to her was that I've learned through hard experience that tailoring is so gendered. What will be made as a women's blazer is constructed completely differently to a men's blazer. Like, you know, it'll be constructed with an hourglass shape in mind. And, you know, I can't put my body inside those kind of women's clothes anymore because it causes so much dysphoria. But then, you know, nor can I find, it's very difficult to find men's blazers that fit. So, you know, what do I wear? I think this is a struggle that a lot of non-binary people have.
One of the things you say, I can't remember if it was in the essay or elsewhere, but that your purpose within the essay was to make things, but was to complicate, not to simplify. Is that something you are always seeking to do?
Yes. I think my training as a historian, as an academic, has kind of schooled me to always, I suppose, question conventional narratives about the world and how things operate, and to kind of ask why we think, you know, why we take certain knowledges and stories for granted. And, you know, also, I suppose, just my personal experience of being trans and, as I've said, being non-binary, not fitting inside the gender binary, just gives me this really embodied, lived understanding of the complexity of, you know, our lives as humans in the world and how little of that complexity actually gets caught in language and in art more generally. So I do see capturing that complexity as something that really kind of drives my writing. But, you know, I would be the first person to admit it's really hard because, you know, I think as writers or people working in any artistic medium, like unless we're really pushing ourselves at all times, we fall back on kind of conventions and norms and ways of using language to see the world, which are kind of easy shorthands, but they kind of, they seduce us into conventional ways of thinking and knowing. And it's really a kind of continual challenge not to be seduced into those. And to try and, I suppose, break open the borders of language to see the world in different ways.
Is it hard? Like, do you find it a hard experience? Because you're setting it, like, it's such a task, isn't it? It's not fiction.
It's incredibly hard.
Like, it's the real world you're writing about.
It's incredibly hard, but it's incredibly rewarding. You know, I've had a lot of therapy in my life, which, you know, has been useful. But I think writing, like finding words to write about my embodied experience of the world, and to kind of to assert my embodied experience as real and as meaningful in a way that I'd never seen it kind of recorded or reflected back at me before. I think more than any therapy I've done, that was such a healing process and such a process of kind of self-reclamation and self-respect.
It's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, like so many, you know, like most trans people, and I think like many marginalized people, I've struggled with a huge amount of internalized transphobia and shame and those kind of difficult emotions. And being able to put words to my experience to kind of, you know, I suppose put my mark on the universe has been more than anything the thing that has enabled me to speak back to that shame and, you know, hopefully might, you know, give, you know, readers potentially struggling with their own sense of feeling outsiders or not belonging, you know, their own little glimmer of being worthwhile and valuable as well.
Eve, what advice do you have for other writers or people that are wanting to write about their own lives?
I think there's a few things I'd say. I mean, I think firstly, it's not for everyone. You know, it is quite an exposing experience, obviously. And, you know, once what you've written is published and the world, you lose control over it and people will read things into it and make assumptions about you that, you know, are not necessarily desirable and you have no control over. So, you know, I think there are many people for whom writing about their experience can be a really useful form of self-understanding and really cathartic, but they just don't have the kind of personality where they would want that work published. And I think that's totally valid. But I think for, you know, for trans and other marginalized people, there's a lot of pressure to kind of give our trauma to the world, to kind of commercialize our trauma and our stories. And I don't, you know, we have no obligation to give our trauma to anyone or to give our stories to anyone. So firstly, I'd say only do it if it's something that you actually want to do. But secondly, I think it's important to also remain mindful of how much control you have over the writing. You know, since publishing the Calibre essay, a lot of people have said to me about, you know, how brave that must have been because how, you know, exposing and vulnerable it was. And yeah, there's a lot of personal, like very personal material I talk about in that essay, but it didn't actually really feel like an exposing thing to do for me because I felt like at every step of the way I had complete control over that story. You know, I was choosing every single word, every single sentence construction. And there's a lot that isn't published there. There's a lot I held back. I am, you know, the master of that scene. And that control is really important to me. I think, you know, I would feel very differently about having my story told through another medium where I wasn't in control, you know, like through photography or film or someone else writing about me. That would be a very different kettle of fish. But that kind of authorial control, I suppose, gives me a sense of safety and, you know, allows me to set boundaries and set limits about what I'm willing to say and how I'm going to say it. And also to be conscious that this is not my life. This is an artistic representation of my life. So there is that kind of distancing there. So I think they're the main two things I'd say is, you know, think very carefully about whether this is something you want to do to write about your life and why you want to do it, but also to kind of own your control over the story you want to tell and to think very carefully how you use that control.
That is great advice. Final question, what is your favourite novel by a debut author?
Well, in a funny way, this is a hard question to answer because I probably the last few years have read a lot more memoir than fiction. So if it's okay, I'd like to give...
should have said favourite book. Normally we do favourite book. I should have said, what is your favourite book by a debut author? Take two.
Well, I really love... I think there's some really extraordinary life writing going on in Australia by young female writers. I've read a lot of really amazing books in that space this year. So I just want to give a shout out to two. which is Blue Breeze by Elena Savage, which is this really extraordinarily beautiful book of essays that are kind of life writing, but, you know, very experimental and really hard to categorise. The second one is I Choose Elena by Lucia Crowley Osborne, which is a really, again, it's like stunningly insightful account of kind of, you know, trauma and healing and gender and identity. And what I love about both these books, like they're both exquisitely written on a sentence by sentence level, but they're also so powerful in the way they take the kind of, the really kind of meatiness, the flesh and blood of people who are assigned female at birth, their everyday lives, their everyday traumas and, you know, experiences of patriarchy and misogyny, and make them the stuff of, you know, exquisite art. And, you know, I mean, obviously we've had, you know, women writing back against a male canon for centuries, but I still think there's a real political potency for, to people centering women's bodies and their ordinary lives as worthy subjects of kind of high art. And finally, if you'll allow me to give one other book.
I will.
There's so much great things I mentioned this year. Back in June, when like Black Lives Matter was kind of blowing up in the United States and in Australia and around the world, you know, that prompted me to do a lot of thinking about my own whiteness and the way I like uphold white supremacy in my own lives, kind of unknowingly, even though I, you know, think of myself as anti-racist. And I suppose it made me think about the whiteness of what I read and how that whiteness colonizes my thinking. So I made a resolution back in June for the rest of the year to only, you know, to for my leisure reading, which is a lot because I'm an obsessive reader still, to only read books by BIPOC writers. So that's Black, Indigenous, or people of color writers. And this has been a transformative experience in so many ways. I've discovered so many amazing writers. It's made me realise how much, you know, it's kind of confirmed my hunch, I suppose, how much my kind of, my pervasive sense that whiteness is still the kind of, you know, the default norm is upheld by the whiteness of what I read. There's been heaps of amazing writers I've discovered, but one I'd like to give a particular shout out to is the debut novel by Jessie Tu, A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing, which just came out with Alan and Unwin, I think last month. This is her debut novel. I haven't finished yet, but it's just extraordinarily good, really funny, really biting, and, yeah, a really wonderful read.
Oh, great recommendation.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.